Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:13 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is Friday. It's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes on September 9th. I thought we'd kick off with the yield curve spread. We're still in negative territory, so this is an inverted yield curve. And I think that's a simple enough determination. It went inverted first in April, had a quick rebound, began to become inverted again in June, categorically inverted at the beginning of July, and we're still there. And this is one of the more important points. The longer the inversion is sustained for, the greater the likelihood is that we are going to have a recession. And we can see that back in 2019, it was inverted for a brief period, but that was a sufficient lead indicator for future trouble. And the longer we go back in history, the greater the efficacy is for the entire signal. So we can look at the various inversions in the past, and then we can correspond those to the big problems that we've had. Certainly, we had a triple waterfall crash in 2006 because we had this massive liquidity crisis. And there are some of those types of threats brewing right now in Europe. When we have tighter liquidity, it's always beneficial to think about where the epicenter of risk is. And that's what I want to do in the first portion of this broadcast today, is to talk about where the epicenter of risk resides. Then we can go back and think about 1999, 2000. We had a brief inversion in 1998. Then there was a surge of new liquidity, but nothing on the scale, for example, that we had between 1989 and 1992. Then subsequently, we had another inversion in early 2000, and that really was the end. And usually it is when we start to see significant trends up through 50 basis points. That's usually the point at which stock markets really start to panic. And there's a good reason for it, because it's at that point that earnings start to deteriorate. And there's clear evidence of economic contraction. And then central banks panic and they abandon any semblance of trying to tighten policy, and they cut interest rates aggressively, and that's what then creates a positive yield curve spread. And we see that, and it's very graphically illustrated on this chart, that it takes a lot shorter time for the spread to go up than it does for it to come down, with the exception of the present condition. This is a clear lower high. It took 18 months for the mild inversion in 2019 to get up to a peak in early 2021, and it's taken less than a year for it to come back down into a negative condition. So there's been a lot of tightening going on in a short period of time, and central banks all over the world are raising interest rates. So this is siphoning liquidity out of the markets. So then let's look at the total assets of central banks, because it got up to an important peak last year. And because of the strength of the dollar, it has contracted meaningfully by about 10% over the course of this year alone. But most of that has been dollar strength. It's not like we've seen central banks lopping trillions off the value of their balance sheets. But nonetheless, the total has been coming down. It peaked in February around 33 trillion. Now we're at 29.6 or 29.7. So this is a meaningful contraction. It's the largest contraction in liquidity that we have seen. Now, of course, we are in a reasonably new environment because prior to 2006, this chart didn't really have much history. It wasn't a wasn't a point worth discussing the size of the global central bank balance sheets. But we're in a new environment after 2008 and quantitative easing. And let's not forget that back in 2007, the idea of money printing on this scale would have been anathema to 99% of people. And yet, now here we are, and we're in 2022, and the idea that this condition might end is anathema to most people. But that is the possibility, because we're now seeing the fruits of that money printing. We've had massive asset price appreciation, and we've had appreciation in the price of everything. So it's not that we have highly valued equity prices. We have highly valued bond prices, highly valued property prices, highly valued collectibles prices, highly valued crypto prices, highly valued NFT prices, and highly valued assets that are in the private sector, most particularly private companies. So this fountain of liquidity that's been pouring into the markets for the last 16 years has inflated the price of just about everything. And nobody wants to really begin to contemplate what the world will look like without it. So obviously, we're in a very difficult situation. One, and let me just think then, we list where the most chronic points of overvaluation reside. I think let's start in China. The Chinese property bubble has been inflating for a long time. It has been the primary vehicle that has inflated in price because Chinese individuals have been constrained in where they've been able to put their money. So with a casino-like attitude in the stock market, an immature corporate bond market, and then an artificial divergence between the borrowing rate and the or the lending rate and the deposit rate in the banking sector, then the only place for Chinese consumers to put their money has been into property. And that has resulted in this phenomenally large advance in prices. So that's where we know there is a concentration of leverage and risk. Now let's think about Europe. Well, I've posted this meme, and I know that it's a little off color, but it is indicative of what's happening in what's happened in Europe. One thing that we can see in every major bull market is contradiction. So in China, they can there's an obvious contradiction that you can keep building, and you can build whole cities that will lie vacant. You can have 70 million housing units vacant, and still those prices will remain escalated indefinitely, and prices will do nothing but rise. And obviously, this attitude that prices can only go up, well, anyone who's lived through 2008 in the USA and in Ireland or Spain, well, then they have experienced what the blind belief in property prices only go up means. So that's an obvious contradiction. And then in Europe, we have this additional contradiction. So, and it's very simple that a teenager is adequately credentialed to give energy policy advice to the rest of the world. And that's exactly what we've had in Europe. We've had a child who has been put forward as the face of the green movement, and her words being used as gospel, which in any other set of circumstances would be viewed as absolute foolishness. But that hasn't deterred politicians from making decisions about the outlook for the energy sector based upon the prognostications of a teenager. So obviously, this is a massive contradiction. And Europe is now living with the repercussions of closing down coal-fired power stations, closing down nuclear stations, refusing to invest in additional new supply, and also then deciding that instead of developing a comprehensive energy independence strategy, they would rely instead on a authoritarian neighborhood government in Russia to supply them with all the natural gas they need. Now, I can fully understand the difficulty in Germany that they absorbed Eastern Germany, and that had historically been run by communists. So, in order to try and create a social harmony environment, they became friendlier with Russia. And I can absolutely see all of the rationale and rationalization that went on to allow that to happen. But we're now living with the repercussions of that. And this phenomenally large move that we've had in European natural gas prices is certainly something that's going to be painful. Now, we have had a significant pullback over the last 3 weeks and quite a bit of volatility this week. And I suspect at least that that this is at least a peak of near-term and potentially medium-term significance. Europe has successfully filled up a lot of their storage. So the knock-on effect then was for Russia to just simply cut it off. Now, of course, what Russia can also do, and what they are more likely to do if the war is not going in their favor in Ukraine, would be simply to cut off natural gas to Ukraine. And that, of course, is going to be significantly problematic for most of Eastern Europe, because not only does Ukraine get its gas from Russia, but they also allow transit through Ukraine into much of Eastern Europe. If things don't go well for Russia on the battlefield, well, then they have absolutely no need to continue to support those economies. So obviously then they'll attempt to tighten the screws. So what it's reasonable to anticipate is we're going to have additional volatility. And the very other clear fact is that storage facilities for natural gas are there to provide overflow. They're not there to provide base load. So the entire energy sector in Europe was designed around pipelines where there would be constant supply, and then storage facilities were created because of the need for surge supply. So that storage is really only there as a stopgap measure. And there's no way that Europe is going to be able to meet the demands for natural gas this winter, which means they're going to have to fire up coal-fired power stations. They're going to have to keep nuclear reactors still underway. And they're going to have to pioneer medium-term solutions too. So the uranium ETF has bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average and the 200-day moving average, and this looks like a first step above the base. And we're still miles away from where the prices were back in 2010. So this really is very early days in a new bull market. At the technology edge of the nuclear sector, small modular reactors. NuScale is firming now from the region of the low from last week, and this has been a really substantial breakout over the last while. Rolls-Royce is going to be building a small modular reactor factory in the north of England, but it's also really experiencing a great deal of pain because fewer planes are flying and because of staffing shortages in European airports. They just simply are cancelling large numbers of flights, and then that's having a knock-on effect for servicing agreements. But the share is steadying somewhat in here today, or at least in here this week, and pausing in here today. Now, the challenge for the aspirations to become a small modular reactor exporter for Rolls-Royce is Doosan Enerbility. They've already built their factory, and they're starting to produce reactors for NuScale and for the Danish company. Their name escapes me. It's not a listed company in any case that's going to be building reactors on board ships. And Doosan Enerbility is not rallying either. It was down reasonably heavily in here today. So I think we're not quite there yet in terms of the demand for brand new technology, but rather that because of the threat that we're seeing, well, then obviously there's this, I think, desire to go with what you know. And betting on the next big thing or the promise of the future isn't quite as popular now as it was only a few years ago. So, Europe obviously has this big contradiction, and it has this exceptionally difficult environment. And the ECB is raising rates aggressively now, 75 basis points this week, and that's on top of the 50 basis points last month. So, this is the fastest pace of interest rate hikes that we've seen. I guess it wasn't last month. Well, yes, it was in July. But this is the fastest rate of interest rate hikes in the ECB's history. I think, though, it's worth reminding ourselves that they tried to raise rates twice in 2011 and then they had to reverse course. And the problem for the Europeans right now is they are inhibited from being aggressive in raising rates. And raising rates isn't going to kill off the inflation that they're experiencing from commodity prices. So, obviously, these are difficult conditions. And when we think about the kinds of bear markets that you get, well, you get structural bear markets, cyclical bear markets, and event-driven bear markets. So let's think about how does that apply to Europe? Well, there's an event. Obviously, there's the war in Russia. That's an event-driven phenomenon. And that's having serious knock-on effects. One of the things, obviously, is in energy and energy generation. And then you have cyclical bear markets. Well, those are generally triggered by central banks. So you get the economic cycle, and you get interest rates starting to move around. When interest rates tighten up, they deter speculative activity and siphon liquidity out of the market, and that's certainly what's underway right now. So that's also a cyclical bear market. Then you also have structural bear markets. So that's usually when there's a shock, and a big enough shock that it creates a liquidity crisis. And then it takes a long time to recover from that. So Europe at the moment is in the event-driven category and is moving into the cyclical category. And I think most of the rest of the world is moving into the cyclical category, where you have the USA, where you have the Federal Reserve raising rates quite aggressively, and you have a negative real interest rate. So, excuse me, you have an inverted yield curve. You still do have negative real interest rates, but that's contracting. And the Fed funds rate is at 2.5%, and there is a lot of talk about raising that by 75 basis points at the next meeting. So that then would take us up to new highs. And this would be a meaningful event because it would break the long-term downtrend. And short-term interest rates peaked at 20% in the early 80s and bottomed at 0.25%. So this is a meaningful move already, and it's been swift. There have been occasions when the Federal Reserve has raised rates faster, but they've usually been at the end of an interest rate cycle, not at the beginning. So this is a very swift pace of interest rate hiking, and they're not done yet. The biggest challenge for central banks is that they usually have really only one central mandate, which is to control inflation, and they're pretty much all failing at it right now. And then the Federal Reserve has the other mandate, which is to promote full employment. Well, they have full employment, so that means that they have a free hand to try and target inflationary pressures, and that is problematic when we have year-over-year inflation at 8.5%. And I started to notice food items, or at least the kinds of food items that I buy, going up by. I just was in the supermarket yesterday. I saw something that I habitually buy was up 20%, and I thought that was rather a lot, so I just didn't bother buying it. And I suspect a lot of other people are in the same situation, that they don't feel like they should have to pay 20% more for something they've been habitually buying, so they'll just simply do without. And I feel like I'm being robbed, and I feel like a lot of other people feel the same way. So that's obviously then going to have a knock-on impact on consumer demand. And I think we're talking ourselves and pushing people into a recessionary kind of environment where people decide that they're going to curtail purchases. So then let's look at high yield spreads. So the spread continues to trend higher. Now, it moderated somewhat in here today, but it's still an uptrend overall. Now, one of the reasons why it moderated in here today was because Zscaler came through with really strong earnings. So we had a clear upper dynamic this week in cloud computing. Many of those shares are down in excess of 50%. And looking at Zscaler is, I think, a good example of first how much it went up, and then subsequently how much it came down. So it's done especially well from the low in 2020. The share went from 36 to 379, so it's a 10 bagger at least. And then it dropped from 380 down to about 120. So it lost more than two-thirds of its value. So this is a big upper dynamic in here this week. $33 on a $150 share is a big move. And it suggests that the low is probably in for this sector, or at least part of it. The other big mover in here today was CrowdStrike. And that was also a dynamic move. So certainly a lot of the bearishness that's been attached to the cloud computing sector has contributed to a significant contraction. And now we're starting to see evidence of support building. So we've been through more than a year of downsizing and rationalization and valuation contraction within the sector. Now, CrowdStrike still trades on a PE of 143. So there's obviously a lot of work still to do to bring down valuations, but we are starting to see some evidence of demand coming through. And of course, one of the big benefits of cloud computing is that it does help to mitigate some of the pressure from rising prices, because you don't have to hold inventory of your own servers, and you don't have to replace those servers, you don't have to upkeep them, and you don't have to pay people to do that. Instead, you can outsource it, spread out your payments over a longer period of time, and you'll always be provided with the best in class service and equipment. So that's a powerfully important characteristic for corporations that will be investing in the cloud. So that's going to support it. It's not like cloud computing is going to disappear. Obviously, we can think about the data center providers, and Equinix is one of those. So it's also pulled back, but it was in positive territory in here today. And it's trading on a valuation of about 32. Now, there's no real good reason for that. And it might go sideways for a good long time to allow that valuation to get better. But at least it's not collapsing right now. But I think it's also worth reminding ourselves that the better these types of companies do, and the stronger the consumer is, the more consumer demand there's likely to be. And the more consumer demand there's likely to be, well, then that's the kind of condition that reacts well to tighter interest rates. So Amazon today is bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And this is an important potential area of support. So it is starting to come through here. We have at least some evidence of support building coming through. This is looking more encouraging. But a recession has not yet started. So we are in this sort of difficult environment. And this is always what happens after an inverted yield curve. You get an initial shock and fears about a recession. But there's a long lead time between the inversion and when the recession actually starts. So prices start to go back up because you have not yet seen a hit in terms of earnings in companies. And that's exactly where we are right now. Ultimately, siphoning liquidity out of the market, where you have an inverted yield curve, rising rates, higher yields, and then tighter, or sorry, excuse me, wider high yield spreads, that eventually creates tight conditions. So let's think then about where are the other big bubbly activities. Well, obviously, we have a lot of very highly valued companies. And the only real comparison that we have for the success of the Fang Man and Tesla companies is the Nifty 50 in the late 1960s. So these companies could do no wrong, and they were uniquely positioned to benefit from the rise of the US consumer and improving living standards, rising wages, rising disposable income, and the rise of the consuming class. And those Nifty 50 companies did spectacularly well. And then we moved into a higher interest rate, higher inflation environment. The good times were not filtering down to enough people, so we then had the civil rights movement, women's liberation movements, and that created a fear complex in the political class, so they decided they were going to spend their way out of trouble and give away lots of goodies. And massive spending, then inflation took off. And then, because the OPEC countries weren't taking part in that and were being paid in depreciating dollars, then they decided that enough was enough, and particularly because of the USA's support for Israel, that was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. And then we had the oil embargoes. So that decimated the valuations of those companies. So now let's think about the fact first that the initial peak for those eight companies relative to the wider market was in August of 2020. And since then, they've pretty much performed in line with the wider market. So this long sequence of events that contributed to massive outperformance, where they have accumulated a position eight companies representing 21% of the entire market's market cap. So I'm not talking about the NASDAQ 100 or the S&P 500. This is the entire NYSE market cap, where we have Apple with a market cap today of 2.5 trillion. That's worth more than all of the energy sector, or worth more than the entire automotive sector. And it doesn't matter what sector you decide to pick, Apple's probably worth more than it. So that's a phenomenally large advance for a company that derives two-thirds of its income from handsets. And the iPhone is a highly cyclical product. People don't generally tend to buy one until the battery starts becoming unreliable, and that implies a 3-year product cycle. The fact that the company wasn't able to raise prices during the product meeting this week suggests that they're as aware as anyone else that consumers are pretty much tapped out, and they're not going to pay up for enhancements that are incremental, that what they want now is a justification before they're going to go out and spend $1,100 on a new phone. Microsoft is probably the poster child of a company that moved from a cyclical market to a subscription model, which made its revenues much more reliable and predictable. But that was possible because it's a service company. It's software as a service. Apple wants to get there. So they are not raising prices, and they are trying to encourage people to use the services that they offer because they want that reliable income. But the barrier to entry for the Apple ecosystem is still very expensive. You have to spend well in excess of $2,000 if you're going to have the phone and the AirPods and the watch, and to get the full experience of what Apple offers. So that's a really significant barrier to entry. And it's hard to say that they're going to be able to grow their subscriber base. I've always taught my children one thing, and it's that when you're playing a game, then what you're actually playing is the creator of that game. And on your phone, you're not playing to win. You're playing to see whether you can succeed in the game without agreeing to make additional purchases. And the less money you spend on a game, the more valuable it becomes. Because I've always tried to instill in them this view that it's on a pay per play metric. So they're both actively playing computer games. And I always talk to them afterwards about how much was that game and how many hours did they spend playing it and have they engaged in the community and played it with their friends. Because if you've spent 100 hours on a game and you've spent $10 on it, well, then that's a cheap game. If you spent $70 on a Nintendo game and you only spent use it for 5 or 6 hours, that's an expensive game. If you spent $70 on a game but you've been playing it for 5 or 6 years and it's your primary vehicle to play with your friends so that you can chat over Discord, well, then that's a vital game. And then we can think about how Apple is trying to sell those products to people. And they're trying to get people to engage with those products. But the products that they're offering, like Apple Music, well, Apple Music is nothing like Spotify. So Spotify has declined in a very meaningful way, but it's bouncing from the $100 area. And this has been a meaningful contraction. But the one thing that I've noticed is that when I talk to my kids about what subscription services do we want, and the number one that they will not give up is Spotify. We've been in and out of Netflix, and we've been in and out of Hulu and Peacock and lots of those streaming services. And we don't have cable TV because nobody in the house spends any time really watching sport. But the one thing they will not let go of is Spotify. And I find that especially interesting because we've had the trials for Apple Music and for Amazon Music. But the one they keep coming back to is Spotify. And they certainly. Will they've made very clear arguments that that is the one they want to hold on to more than anything else. And I find it interesting that the share has really not been performing, but at least it's putting in a base formation. But they're not using Apple Music. So I do think that there is obviously a lot of trading going on. And Apple this week is bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. But nothing has happened to question the cyclicality of the company. And I do think that as we look at what are the primary things that companies like Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, or Alphabet, and Facebook, or what they call themselves now, Meta Platforms, which is it's frankly ridiculous. And we can think about Netflix and Nvidia. The one thing that they have in common is they benefited enormously from low interest rates, access to abundant liquidity, globalization, and the growth of the global consumer. So they were able to then leverage 4G and access a global marketplace, fund that growth with free money. And because they were running largely digital operations, they were able to push out their products with very low barriers to entry. So these are, I think, significant factors that they all have in common. Now, obviously, Tesla, as a major manufacturer of physical objects, has blurred the lines because they were able to first benefit from regulatory arbitrage, then they built their factories, and they've been selling the cars, and they have the computer and Wi-Fi component so that they can send out software updates. And what I've also found interesting is that the repo, or the repossessions of Teslas, are greatly facilitated by the company because they can take remote control of the car, they can back it out of parking spaces, they can back it up onto a trailer, and the repo man can just take it away. They don't need the keys. So these are significant innovations. Then let's just think about it. Interest rates are rising, and we have a big uncertainty about the energy sector. At the very minimum, governments are becoming more active, and that's definitely something we're seeing in Europe, and we're definitely seeing it in the UK because Europe has no choice. They have to introduce price caps. And price caps will bring down inflation. There's absolutely no question of that. But then the decisions made by Liz Truss this week, relative to the decisions made in much of Europe, are very telling. So the Truss administration in the UK has said they're not going to engage in windfall taxes. Now, I don't know how long that's going to last because the energy companies are having huge profits because of their lack of investment in new supply, and frankly, they'd be mad to invest in long-dated supply projects when they don't know what the regulatory environment is going to be. And that's not going to be politically palatable for a lot of consumers when they are chilly in their homes and they see their living standards deteriorating. But there is a rationale for not taxing those windfall profits because it's not going to further disincentivize those companies from increasing supply. So then that will remove some of the inflationary pressures from the future. Whereas in Europe, what they're doing, particularly in France, is vilifying the energy companies, setting up the potential for windfall profits, and therefore robbing those companies of the resources they require to enhance supply in future, and therefore creating future bottlenecks, which will then contribute to a significant inflationary problem in future. So, as we think about the major trends, well, we know that inflation is a potential medium-term threat, whereas the last decade we've had disinflation. We've been through lengthy periods of time where governments have spent less, are being less active in markets. Now they're becoming more active. Geopolitical stresses are rising. They're not de-escalating. So that's also problematic, where Europe relied on Russia to provide them with cheap commodities, and the USA basically relied on China to provide it with cheap consumer goods. Well, then that's not as reliable a network as it was before. And of course, that then questions the globalization trend. When I was writing Crowd Money in 2013, the rise of the global consumer was obvious, and we had this huge advance in terms of the number of people that were new consumers, and their consumption potential was rising in a manner similar to what we saw in the 1960s with the Nifty 50, except that it was now a global phenomenon. And we're talking, instead of a few hundred million people, billions of people. And that was the condition for a big bull market, which is, of course, what we had. And now we're seeing deglobalization and fragmentation of that global supply chain and more friendshoring. So that's been a really significant development for India. It benefits both from access to cheap energy from Russia and access to technology and markets in the West. So India is sitting right in the middle of this increasing geopolitical environment, and it is sufficiently large that it can avoid being bullied around. And what I find interesting is that the Nifty index is steady here and firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. And the Indian rupee is stable. Now, we've had an exceptional amount of volatility in the currency markets. So let's just then think about what were the other things that helped to support those large companies, though. Well, obviously digitization. Well, I don't believe that digitization is going to change. There's going to be certainly a lot more interest in cybersecurity, and the cybersecurity ETF has also been steadying here this week, but it is still below the 1,000-day moving average. The problem with cybersecurity is it's hard to make money from. People don't like paying for it. But it is a reflection of the digitization trend. And when you have higher interest rates around and you have a difficulty or you have roadblocks in terms of the free movement of capital around the world, then that contributes to inflationary pressures. It probably means that even though we're going to have interest rate volatility, and we are seeing interest rates rising at the moment really fast, and I think that's most particularly relevant to pay attention to what's happening in Brazil. So Brazil has raised rates exceptionally violently over the course of the last 18 months. Back at the beginning of this cycle, in February of 2021, the interest rate was 2%, and at the moment it's 13.75%. So they've raised rates by 1,175 basis points, which is a lot. And it basically killed off consumer demand. So that has helped to get control of inflation. And the central bank in Brazil now anticipates that inflation is going to be around 6% in December. So then they're going to that has resulted in hugely positive real interest rates. And it's helped to support the currency. So even though the dollar has been surging against the euro and the pound and the yen, well, instead, against the Brazilian real, it's been falling. Now, we're in an interesting situation because of that huge knock-on effect on the consumer in Brazil. There is an election coming up, and the outcome of that election is practically polarized. You're either going to have a right-wing radical or a left-wing radical taking power. So the currency's been a bit volatile over the last few weeks. But the reality is that whoever wins the election is going to inherit positive real interest rates and the potential for significant recovery. So I do think that this is potentially what we can anticipate from much of the rest of the world, especially for commodity producers, because whatever it is Brazil is selling, the rest of the world needs, whether it is soybeans, iron ore, or coal or oil, the rest of the world needs it. And the digitalization trend is very much in play, and the central bank has been sponsoring the fintech sector. So PagSeguro also has base formation characteristics, and it's beginning to steady, and it came through with really quite strong earnings last week or 2 weeks ago. And it's very well positioned for interest rates to start coming down in Brazil. So, as we think about then those factors that have contributed to the big bull market in the FAANG Man shares over the last 14 years, they're not as favorable for those companies now as they have been. And it suggests to me that the 50% of the S&P with a PE greater than at 20, and that's in terms of market cap. 20% of the mark, excuse me, 50% of the market cap of the S&P has a PE of more than 20, then there is obviously potential for significant valuation contraction. And that's especially true the longer interest rates rise and the more liquidity is siphoned out of the market. And then the big question is, there's been so much money. I personally think the biggest bubble that we have is in private assets. And what I find especially interesting is we have this enormous success story from Blackstone. They saw the huge decline in property prices during the last crisis, and they invested heavily in residential properties. And of course, that contributed to a great deal of upset among the population that they are basically confined to being renters for the rest of their lives. And this buying of residential properties by Wall Street firms has contributed to asset price inflation. And prices getting out of the way are the ability of consumers to keep up. So then there's the potential that you're going to have government getting involved in that as well. Now there's billions and, in fact, trillions of money set aside to buy at really attractive valuations. And they want these income-producing type of plays. So you can have, I've seen pitch decks for aircraft leasing, but helicopters. And helicopters being leased out to medevac. So these are very much attuned to the rural people that need hospital care. So And that's in places like Australia and in remote parts of the USA and Canada. And there is a high IRR in those types of investments. There's a high IRR in these residential real estate types of investments. And certainly, what companies are looking for is the predictability of cash flows. But then, are they going to have the sufficient lobbying power to avoid the ire of consumers? I think that's one of the biggest risks that these types of companies have. It's not just about interest rates, but it's about being able to iterate on these plans. And then the value of all that money and trillions of dollars that have been set aside for these kinds of investments. Where did that money come from? How is it that it's been concentrated in so few hands? And how susceptible is it to rising interest rates? So, when we think about the bond markets, I think the total return on the 10-year treasury has been trending down, and the 10-year yield is up to 3.3%. So, on a closing level, this is a new high this week. And this might only be the upper side of the base formation for Wall Street or for US Treasuries. But when we look at the 10-year gilt in the UK, then it's way above where it was in 2013. So this has been a very accelerated move. Now, accelerations don't last indefinitely. And when you see an accelerated move like this, well, then it's rarely productive to to predict that it's going to persist indefinitely or urgently. There's obviously potential for at least some pause and consolidation. But the trend is clear. And we have a very clear sequence of higher reaction lows. And it has broken the long-term trend overall. So the more back history you look at, the bigger this move is. Most particularly, it's when we look at the 1,000-day moving average. And every time it has broken above that, it has failed. And now we are miles away from the 1,000-day moving average. Now let's think about where some of the other bubbly activity has been. And it's been most particularly in Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, and UK property. Well, rising interest rates are obviously problematic. And then, of course, it has to do with inflation. Inflation tends to show up in property prices. So that's significant. And Canadian yields are up to 3.13 right now. And at the beginning of 2021, they were closer to 75 basis points. And then let's look at Australian government bonds. And the RBA has been raising rates, and the yield is up to 3.5. So anyone who bought on a floating rate mortgage over the course of the last 3 years has basically seen their interest payment double. And that has knock-on effects for consumption. So we're certainly seeing more enthusiasm for buying right now because we have oversold conditions. And the ASX 200 was another index that put in a higher reaction low in here this week. But monetary conditions continue to tighten. And we're in this environment where we're still at the point where people are willing to welcome the fact that the central bank is acting to inhibit inflation and that we can still have a soft landing everywhere. Now, I don't doubt that we're going to have a soft landing somewhere, but a soft landing everywhere looks like an awfully big ask. And this is against a background where property prices in a large number of markets are fully valued. Now, it's also about supply and demand. So in the most attractive areas where there's less demand, less supply, then prices aren't likely to fall as far. But that doesn't mean they have to continue to rise into an environment where there's less liquidity. So we're still in a difficult environment. And inflationary pressures are going to have to come down hard. And central banks are going to have to reverse course in order to clearly signal that we are back in a demand-dominated environment for asset prices. Considering the changes that are going on underway for the primary animating factors for the big trend over the last 14 years, I think it makes more sense to start to think about the strength of cash flows, the growth potential because of near-term technological innovation. I think those are the kinds of sectors that will be rewarded. That's why some of the fintech companies are starting to do better now because in the emerging markets, because they're close to the top of their interest rate cycle. When we think about the commodity complex, I think that there's an enormous debate going on, and we're going to have an awful lot of challenges. When we then think about the monetary environment, gold, for example, does best in a negative real interest rate environment. We've had that for a decade, and gold has been up and down. So a negative real interest rate environment is not a sufficient condition for a gold bull market. But instead, what we also need to have is a weak dollar. And the dollar is still really quite firm. So gold prices are holding the $1,700 area, and the dollar index was down today and yesterday. But it was well off the low as we're coming up to the end of trading. So this looks like a consolidation. The reality is that the Federal Reserve is probably going to continue raising rates. And as long as they are actively withdrawing liquidity from the global market, I also think that there's a geopolitical aspect to this. One of the primary arguments that Russia is using about the dollar is that the USA is willing to flog the value of the currency in service to supporting domestic asset prices. And since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, the USA has done nothing but raise rates. And they are actively moving to support the currency. So the USA is heavily dependent on basically fiscal transfers from the rest of the world. And the willingness of foreign governments and foreign investors to buy treasuries. And that's obviously been put in play because Russia and China are no longer buying treasuries. So the Federal Reserve is basically creating a market for those securities by ensuring that the currency is strong. And as long as that remains the case, it's going to be difficult for gold to move into a really significant bull market. Of course, what it also ensures is that in terms of purchasing power, the USA has a clear advantage in oil. So oil prices are still around $86 on West Texas Intermediate, and natural gas prices are still well contained below the $10 level and back to around 8 right now. Whereas when we think about the energy complex, I do think that this argument we have around copper, there's a lot of exceptionally bullish arguments, but I think perhaps the one thing everyone has learned is that we need an energy mix, and we cannot rely on a single technology. So electric vehicles are going to have to come down in price, and that's just not possible with high commodity prices. So therefore, there's going to have to be investments in alternatives. And I think it's no longer really correct to talk about renewable energy. I think what we really need to start thinking about is alternative energy. So, Andrew Forrest with Fortescue is building a world-scale green hydrogen production facility in Australia. And that's not the only one. And the share is at least bouncing now from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, one of the factors that has contributed to the underperformance of industrial resources has been China. And more than any other factor, China's unwillingness to support the property market and intervene with a big stimulus program to support the economy has contracted commodity prices. And it's been a disinflationary force for the rest of the world. But the Party Congress is coming up in October, and I think this is one of the most important factors. What happens after the Party Congress when Xi Jinping has been established as leader for life? Well, he's going to have to try and support the domestic economy. And to me, at least, that suggests there's greater potential for additional support mechanisms coming into the market. And I think looking at what happens in China, vis-a-vis what's happening in the industrial metal complex is going to give us an idea of what to expect from the global commodity markets. We know that the USA is going to end the outflows from the strategic petroleum reserve in October, and oil prices have done nothing but come down since the beginning of that. So there's the potential then that Chinese stimulus and the end of the outflows from the strategic reserve will support prices. And the price has come back towards the upper side of the base formation. So I think that over the next 3 or 4 months, we can anticipate a good share of volatility. And I don't believe that this corrective phase has ended quite yet, because it's not just about monetary policy. There are lots of other factors that are coming to play in here right now. I do want to highlight as well the resilience of the biotech sector. And it was up in here again today, and this looks like an inverted head and shoulders. So this is an example of near-term technological success. We've had the proof of use case in terms of developing vaccines for the pandemic, and now the onus is on these companies to provide near-term solutions for other intractable human conditions like arthritis or like oncology. And it does look increasingly encouraging that those are the kinds of things we can anticipate. So I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.